Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Tuesday morning. It is the 19th of May. Very nice to have you with us. A special lockbox edition of the roundtable panel. Please, you heard all of the incredible things that Maddie and David had to say about the importance of giving to this radio station during the lockbox time. So at any time when you you hear something and you feel compelled, or maybe you hear something that you don't like and you feel compelled to take a moment out, those are great times to go to a device or a phone and, well, call us and help us out in any way, shape, or form that you possibly can. WAMC.org, 1-800-323-9262. Let me introduce the group to you. We'll get started. We're going to 10:30 this morning. And we look forward to a good conversation. We have a lot of big topics to discuss here, so we'll get going. First of all, we welcome Associate Professor of Music at Vassar College, Justin Patch is here. Good morning, Justin. How are you?
Good morning. It's great to be here. It's summer, so I feel good.
Yeah, it is. It's warm. It's sultry. It's very nice. It feels much different than it did. Fatima Gilliam is here, author, lawyer, consultant, public speaker, and entrepreneur. Was with us yesterday for an interview, today for the panel. And Fatima, it's wonderful to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to get into this conversation and see where it goes.
Me too. Just so you know, Fatima's new book is Race Rules, What Your Black Friend Won't Tell You. Speaking of books, Laurel Elder is here, professor of political science at Hartwick College in Oneonta, studies gender and politics, women political candidates, women voters, and women in elected office, is the co-author of the brand new book, Not Going Back, Public Opinion on Abortion in Post-Dobbs America. First of all, Laurel, congratulations. It's wonderful to have you here. Congratulations on the new book.
Thank you so much. It's so great to be here.
Now, we have a lot to talk about news-wise, but at 10:30 after the news break, Laurel and I will be here and we'll talk about the book in detail. So we look forward to that discussion coming up at 10:30 this morning. We always welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and you can get in on the discussion, and we hope indeed that you do. All right, so we go to the news of the day, and we're going to start off with Iran. There was a version of this story from the New York Times yesterday morning that was online, and I think it was the one that was printed, and it said, will he or won't he? Trump threatens Iran. Will he actually do anything on this? The answer is no. So, and by the way, please do not interpret that in any way, shape, or form as me being disappointed that nothing is being done. That is certainly not the case. But I do think this, as the president has repeatedly said, that he'll restart military action against Iran, only to stop short of plunging the United States directly back into an unpopular war, seems to be something that is on the playlist and is on repeat. So, President Trump, this from the New York Times, President Trump said Monday he had authorized a new wave of attacks against Iran this week, but he was going to hold off to make room for, quote, serious negotiations, after he said three Gulf leaders requested more time to work out a nuclear deal. Mr. Trump has repeatedly threatened to launch new strikes only to pull back at the last minute from plunging the United States back into an unpopular, expensive war. On Monday, he confirmed plans to strike and then canceled them at the same time. We were getting ready to do a very major attack tomorrow, he said. And I put it off for a little while, hopefully forever, but possibly for a little while, because we've had a very big discussion with Iran and we've seen what they amount to. When Mr. Trump launched the war alongside Israel on February 28th, he estimated that it would end in 3 to 4 weeks. 4 to 5 weeks. I apologize. The conflict is now entering its third month. And Mr. Mm-hmm. Trump is caught between dueling impulses to force Iran into submission and to declare victory and move on. That is a soupçon of the article from the New York Times. And I wanted to turn this over to our panelists. Laurel.
Well, I think this article underscores something that I think we all know, which is that this war has become longer and more complicated than President Trump expected. As you said, he initially suggested this war would only last 4 to 5 weeks. It's now entered its third month, and there does not seem to be a clear end in sight. And Trump is clearly trying to project strength and maybe some unpredictability, thinking this might get him what he wants, but it hasn't happened. So despite our military attacks, despite our military strength, our tactical successes in, you know, hitting military targets and leaders, Iran remains resilient. And importantly, its nuclear stockpile has not been eliminated. So now, you know, Donald Trump is under intense pressure to avoid a politically damaging endless war, exactly the kind of military conflict that he campaigned against. And we can see that it's really damaging his poll ratings. Also in the New York Times yesterday were new poll results showing that his approval rating is now at 37%, which is the lowest in his second term. It's lower than where he was during his first term, lower than Biden was at this point in his presidency. And Biden was not very popular. So his approval rating has gone down about 4 percentage points since January. So it seems like this Iran conflict is really dragging down his approval rating. And I think it's putting pressure on him to try to figure out what to do, but yet there's not a lot of clear options.
Justin.
I mean, when I saw this the story pop up, I said to myself, I can't imagine being the Naval and Air Force commanders who spent weeks planning an attack only to have the president basically not just say no, but say publicly what we were planning one. I mean, everybody knows that when you're in the military, you're constantly planning. But to have the president basically say there was one, then there wasn't, I can't imagine the frustration.
Mm. Or to put it in a purgatory, like it may not happen, it may happen, it could happen, but maybe not, and we'll see.
Yeah, so that first part is like, oh, what is this man doing? And the second part is that from a cultural standpoint, the Iranians slow roll everything. It's sort of that's their MO. Everything is very methodical. They go to the table with a maximalist approach, and then you work backwards from that. And one of the problems that this war is that it's giving the Iranians proof of concept that they can shut down the Strait of Hormuz, and that other countries are shying away from the massive expenditure to try to go escort oil tankers in and out of the Gulf or in and out of the Strait of Hormuz. And this was something the Iranians had threatened to do, but hadn't done. And then they did it and it's working, which means that Donald Trump has dramatically less leverage mm-hmm. than Barack Obama was dealing with in, 2014, 15, 16, when it took him 20 months to get Jigpoa done. And if it took him 20 months, the Iranian government has already, showed that they will inflict tremendous pain on the 92 million people who live there in order to stay in power. Mm-hmm. So how much longer are they willing to wait, keep the strait closed, participate in asymmetrical warfare? This is not something that's going to get done in 4 to 5 weeks.
Fatima.
Well, I think it's just another example of who Donald Trump and this administration, who they are. They don't have a plan. And Donald Trump is a chaos artist. So this is just more tracking on brand for him. He's going to do more of this. Maybe by later today, we'll be back onto bombing. And then maybe by the time we go to bed, we will have called it off again. I mean, the war is costing us over $1 billion a day, as the Trump family and their cronies are making money off of this war. You know, I mean, there are the hints of insider trading. There have been people talking about for weeks before various announcements happened. There's a spike in trading that takes place. But since this is Trump's government, I don't foresee the Securities and Exchange Commission coming for any of these people. But in terms of what's happening in Iran, I mean, it's time for us to pack up and go home, albeit with our tail between our legs. But we need to leave the Iranian people alone. They did not attack us. But what I also think this does is it's time for us to have a serious analysis of what our policies are in the Middle East and the partnerships that we have and how far we'll follow that rabbit hole. I also think it's an indication that Trump is a terrible negotiator. I mean, sure, he came out with The Art of the Deal, which was written by a ghostwriter, and he's high on his own supply, but he's incompetent. But what I will say, what he's exceptionally good at, you know, he may not be great at wars and being a president, and obviously he's not going to pay attention to where he is in the polls. That's not going to change any significant way his decision making. But he's exceptionally good at dismantling. He's exceptionally good at grifting, profiteering. But he also understands power and how to leverage it on a level that most people don't, which is how he's able to manipulate emotions in a sort of savant level mastery. And what he's also really great at, I think this is his core, you know, best skill is white supremacy. But that's who's running the country.
With that, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we will discuss it more now that we have opening statements out of the way. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'd love to hear from you. Panel at WAMC.org will return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our roundtable panel. It's very nice to have you with us, Oral Elder, Fatima Gilliam, and Justin Patch with us this morning, and we welcome your letters. We go to letters from listeners like you and like Vincent, who says, wait, isn't this the same DJT that said he could end the war in Ukraine in 24 hours? Rex Tillerson, his former Secretary of State, nailed it when he said Trump was a, quote-unquote, moron. The rest of the world isn't going along with the ruse, and neither should we. So what do we do instead? If that's the case, and if anyone wants to answer on Vincent's behalf, like then what do we do?
Okay, I'll jump in there.
Okay, then. There you go. You're going to fill the void. Excellent. Thank you, Fatima. I appreciate it.
I think our options are somewhat limited because, you know, Trump and this administration is proceeding without authorization from Congress, mm-hmm. right, with war powers. And any attempt in Congress to try to rein that in have completely flopped. So a lot of the levers are unavailable to sort of stop this. I mean, we could say, oh, okay, are we going to sit back and wait until we have, like, a new Congress, and if the House and the Senate flip, then maybe they can pull this in. I don't foresee this necessarily ending before 2027. But in terms of what people can do, I think we're in the same position with so many things. What do we do about voting rights? What do we do about this war that's just going to continue to go on? I think people need to start putting pressure on their elected officials. I think people need to start complaining about this. But then I also think the epicenter of getting changed behavior from this administration comes from corporations, comes from Wall Street, comes from where they see the markets impacting. And so maybe that is also an area to try to apply pressure. But it's going to be hard when Congress is just a bunch of lapdogs that go along with whatever song and dance they tell them to tap dance to.
I would agree with many of those points. I mean, the one place where, you know, there could be a change in the Trump administration is if he felt pressure from Republicans, Republicans in the electorate or Republicans in Congress. And there's so many reasons that Republicans could or should be standing up to Trump about this war. As I mentioned before, many Republicans voted for him because of his opposition to military involvement in forever wars in the Middle East. And then we know that this military conflict is undermining the powers of Congress and congressional authority. This war is costing, as Fatima pointed out, a ton of money, which we actually do not have. And certainly there's other things we could be spending this money on. And this war is highly unpopular, as I said. And as we head towards the midterm elections, is putting a lot of Republican seats and the Republican majority at risk. And yet, here's the thing. Despite Trump's overall really low approval ratings, 37%, it looks like the vast majority of Republicans remain supportive of his actions in Iran. I think I saw a poll that 79% of Republicans support Trump's use of force in Iran. And so this is really interesting because it just shows, you know, I sort of think of this as Trump's one of his superpowers, which is that he has been able to maintain this very high level of support among most Republicans, and that they're even willing to switch core issue beliefs to be in alignment with him. So a lot of people who were opposed to military involvement in the Middle East are now supporting it. And I mean, I guess so. And right. And the Republicans in Congress, there's been a few who've stood up and said, no, we need congressional authorization. We're going to invoke the War Powers Act, but not enough to actually pass anything. So it leaves Trump, you know, relatively unchecked and able to continue carrying out this war in the way he wants. And I'll just say one more sort of quick thing, which is that, you know, this sort of has to do with things Fatima said as well. I've always been very interested in presidential decision making, like how presidents make decisions. Because if you think about it, in order for a decision to be made by the president, it's got to be a really, really hard decision. If it's an easy decision, if it's a moderately hard decision, someone else is going to make the decision. So the president gets the most challenging decisions brought to him. And Trump's sort of mode of making decisions has been to rely on his instinct, and he's now surrounded with a strong group of loyalists. And I think that has led to bad decision making in terms of the Iran war. And my fear is that there's been no learning as a response of that. And so we may just see continuing bad decisions, and that Trump doesn't want to feel embarrassed or admit that he made a mistake. And so he might attack again, Iran again, just to sort of avoid having to do that.
I mean, I think this is a moment where, you know, obviously what's pointed out with Congress, nobody wants to be like, well, we'll wait till November and then we'll solve this problem. This is a problem of now. The one thing I will say that I wish sort of the anti-war folks would do is go to tiny media. That was the one big advantage that Trump had over Kamala Harris. He did tons and tons of media hits, sometimes on podcasts that had as few as 9,000 listeners. And what you do is you get out there and you talk about, hey, we're spending $1 billion a day to get back to a place that we had with Jigpoa in 2016. Do we want this? Talk to people about, hey, it's not just about gas prices. It's going to be about food prices, because the other thing that comes out of the Strait of Hormuz is an awful lot of fertilizer that people either didn't get in time or had to pay through the nose for, and that those prices are getting passed on. To talk policy in a sort of casual atmosphere, and to really, instead of waiting for the CNNs and the MSs to call you, to be aggressive about, hey, look, there are, you know, podcasts and YouTube channels and TikTokers that have a following. Let me get a little bit of history across. Let me get some talking points across. Let me talk about the impact of this terrible decision making, and don't sit by idly and wait for either broadcast media or for the House and the Senate to change, because that's a bad game to play.
If I could just add on to something that Justin just said, I think it's not just in terms of spreading the message about gas prices. I think it's also important to spread the message that this is exposing us to threat and attack on the homeland.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, we're engaged in a war with a country that has over 90 million people, and we attacked them, right? We are the aggressor. We could potentially have another 9/11 style attack here. I think it's important for people to understand not just the economic consequence of it, not just the consequence that may be with our military, but what may happen domestically to human lives here beyond the economic impact. But I don't expect leadership in the Democratic Party to be strong and forceful in going out and spreading that message. I mean, you know, I like to call them the do-nothing Dems. I mean, they sit back. I mean, Chuck Schumer, he probably on some level, because he also seems like he's probably a Netanyahu sycophant, he, you know, is not coming out strong and forcefully enough against this. So I don't expect the leadership to do it. So I think it's going to be hard to do. But I do think, yes, to Justin's point, like, people should be going out there using every available platform to meet people, especially since most people consume their news on, you know, through social media or, you know, whatever people post, which is not always fact-checked. So they need to go meet people where they are to get the message out.
And I do think people would be open to this message. I was looking at some Pew polling recently, and already Americans, there's more Americans who say this war with Iran has made the U.S. less safe. More people are saying that than has made us more safe and has made the world less safe rather than more safe. And so when one of the justifications for this military action is we need to do this to create a safer Middle East, a safer world, and a safer America, Americans do not feel that way at all right now. So I think already people are not feeling like this war has made us any safer. And so they're sort of primed for a message like that.
I mean, that was part of the discourse about attacking the hotels in Saudi Arabia and Dubai and Abu Dhabi, the Emirates, was that they had always been so safe, right? So they were considered safe before this war happened. So it's not like, oh, we need to make the Middle East more safe. No, we made it worse, because before this, despite the fact that Israel sort of bangs the drum about this dangerous neighbor, it was not, the Gulf was, it was not there. The Levant, yes, warfare. But so to really go back and give people a bit of a recent history lesson is important.
We're going to go over to, well, go ahead, Fatima.
Yeah, just one final thing. I would say in terms of, you know, the interconnectedness, you know, we could also question or wonder that we may have more attacks like what happened yesterday at the school in San Diego, right? As we engage in a war in the Middle East, that also means people who are Muslims, who go to mosques, are vulnerable to attack by our own domestic terrorists and crazies.
We're going to go over to Lockbox Central in just a moment. And before we do that, I want to read a letter from Robert who says, "This war is not undermining Congress. Congress is undermining Congress, both parties. I don't know how illegal war isn't a constant headline out of the Democratic leadership, complete with its fists slamming on podiums every single day. On the principles of rule of law, fiscal choices, and accountability for the body to do its own job, I understand why the Republicans, save for Massey, aren't doing it." Then we get this from Alana, who says, "Panelists keep saying that we should put pressure on our elected officials to solve our problems. But what if our senators and our congressional representatives are already aligned with our beliefs? Aren't we just preaching to the choir?" All good points. We welcome yours. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We will continue our conversation with this terrific panel in just a moment. But first, we go over to Lockbox Central and hear from David Gustina and Madeline Reynolds. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We'll go for about another 20 minutes or so. Then we're going to go back to the Pledge Central studio and hear more. And then Laurel Elder will stay with us to talk about her new book, Not Going Back. We welcome you and this discussion, panel at WAMC.org. So let's talk about the other big story. I would say huge story, and if it's not clearly my opinion, but if it's not huge, it really, really ought to be huger. And that is the fact of the Trump Ally Fund that is being sent up. The deal was that Trump will drop the suit against the IRS, which then created a $1.8 billion anti-weaponization fund. President Donald Trump has agreed to drop his family's lawsuit against the IRS as part of a highly unusual agreement that establishes a nearly $1.8 billion fund to compensate those who, like him, have claimed they have been targets of a, quote, weaponized justice system. The deal, laid out in documents released Monday, creates what officials described as an anti-weaponization fund with broad authority to distribute payments to individuals with all with limited oversight and outside the normal processes for negotiating legal claims against the government. So, quick shorthand, quick Cliff Notes version. We're paying for it as taxpayers. Congress has no oversight or anyone else as to who gets the money and for what. It is the latest and by far the most sweeping tool the president has aimed at financially rewarding supporters and political allies he asserts have been wronged by Democratic administrations. Under the settlement's terms, the president and his family would be excluded from receiving any money. Legal experts and ethics watchdogs quickly panned the fund. Pan seems like not strong enough a word. Pan the fund is a product of self-dealing that was negotiated between the president and agencies that he oversees at taxpayers' expense. This is one of the single most corrupt acts in American history. Donald Sherman, president of the nonprofit Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, said he noted that although Trump sued the IRS as a private citizen, the officials representing the Internal Revenue Service and the Treasury Department in the settlement negotiations ultimately report directly to him. While Democratic lawmakers called on the judge overseeing Trump's lawsuit to block the deal, she filed an order Monday dismissing that case. Senate Minority Leader Charles Schumer said this is not justice. He added no president should be able to use the Department of Justice as a personal rewards program for the people who helped him attack our democracy. For the record, we should note that the Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche is testifying as we speak, facing questions over the fund. Blanche is testifying to a Senate subcommittee. He is facing questions about the president's fund and talking about why it is, quote, so important. He is sparring with several senators, including Senator Chris Van Hollen, a Democrat of Maryland, over what the senator called an outrageous slush fund for the president's allies. Van Hollen asked if January 6 defendants convicted of beating police officers would be eligible for payouts of taxpayer money. Anyone in this country is eligible to apply if they believe they were victims, Todd Blanche said. And that hearing goes on as we speak. Fatima.
Well, I think it's just another grift by the Trump family and this administration. And I don't believe for a second when they say that Trump and his family aren't supposed to benefit from this. They're always going to find an angle, because they've basically, what their plan is, their continual plan is to monetize the Oval Office and the presidency. It's like corruption is the Trump family credo. And the platform that they now have is the bottomless purse of the U.S. Treasury that they could pickpocket from the public. I think it's extremely alarming, but I don't really expect much from, somebody like Chuck Schumer other than maybe a strongly worded letter, right? Like they've created a piggy bank for billionaires that will be funded by the people's money. But on the other hand, which I know won't go anywhere, but it sounds like it's a fund that should reimburse people like James Comey and Letitia James, and even somebody like E. Jean Carroll, who has had to defend defamation and you know, suing Trump for sexual assault. And it sounds like it's a fund for Don Lemon, but I know those people will never get money. So we should expect more of this, and then we should expect nothing to be done about it.
Laurel.
Well, I will state the obvious, that this is not going to help Americans restore any confidence in our government. Already, Americans, I mean, we're always skeptical of our government, and I think some degree of skepticism and lack of trust is probably healthy in a democracy, but we've really gotten to super high levels of Americans just saying they can't trust our political system, and that I think close to 80% of Americans now think that our nation's political system needs major political changes. And I think this is, you know, just underscores that. And it gets us to the point, I mean, this has been a broad theme for a lot of the topics that have been discussed on the roundtable. But we are experiencing democratic backsliding in the United States. I mean, by all sorts of different measures, this is happening. And it's a concern. So it's not a partisan issue, because I do not think, whether you're Republican, Democrat, or independent, you want to see this kind of behavior coming out of a presidential administration. Now, my fellow panelists, or maybe the audience, might know more about this than me, but it sounded like, from reading the articles about this, that what Trump is doing, there is a legal basis for it. So it's not that it's illegal, but it's breaks norms as he's done throughout his presidency. And I think, once again, it's reminding us of just how much of our democracy and what worked about our democracy was based on norms, democratic norms, rather than laws. And so we're seeing that tension, you know, put to the test again.
So the coverage that I've read and listened to on this brings up a couple of points where this is different from other amelioration funds that have been set up. One, this was not signed off on by a judge. So basically a lawyer drew it up and just put it into action. Two, the panel that is appointed, the president is allowed to fire without cause. So they're literally like, you have to do what the president tells you to do. Otherwise, he can just remove you from that job. And three, there's no standard of public reporting. All three of those things have been part of other similar programs like this. Imagine the fund that was set up after Hurricane Katrina, right? All of those standards were in place. I mean, the Trump administration has brought up the fund for black farmers that the Obama administration set up. All that had oversight. It was signed off on by a judge, and the panel had autonomy from Barack Obama to adjudicate the claims that were put forward. We don't even know what the claims paperwork is. There's no standard. So again, normally these sorts of things are a while in the making, so that a process that passes the legal test can get brought in front of a judge and signed off on. This has had none of those. And that, to me, is the point that where, okay, this is a real problem. Not only does it deviate from norms, but it is ripe for corruption. And I think the reporter from NPR put in a really specific word. She said the Trump family cannot get direct payments from this. So I think her insertion of direct is important, because, you know, kickbacks, we know what this is.
If I could add something, yeah, for sure. Justin is totally right. They're going to figure out a way to make money. And we can't trust the process. But it makes me think of something larger than this, right? Like, every week is some new dumpster fire, some new whiplash scandal, something that erodes democracy, something that shows that the grift is the epicenter, right? Like, that is what they're centering. And all that does, not just in terms of eroding democracy or confidence, right, is in this system, in terms of what Laurel was saying, but people feel hopeless. They feel powerless, especially when we see our elected officials just sort of like sitting back, coasting, and sometimes making really terrible decisions because they're more focused on holding on to power than they are upholding their priority, which is the oath to the Constitution and what's more beneficial for the country than for themselves or their party. And so a lot of people watch this horror show and they're like, well, what can I do? Right? Like, I'm calling my members of Congress. I'm going to protest. I'm following the news, and their efforts seem like they're not having any impact. So for people who are in that position, this is what I say, that they should still remain hopeful. And then if they're trying to say, what should I be doing? I think in this moment in time, what is really important for Americans to focus on is the attack that is taking place against against the Voting Rights Act and voter suppression, so that we can't have free and fair elections on the level that there should be. So if people want something to do that they can get involved in, is I would say focus your energy on combating voter suppression in your community, in other states, in your state, because that will have impact on who can we change in terms of who is our leadership, right? If we can have real tangible change in local elections and communities, who's representing us in Congress and the Senate, right? That is something that people can focus on. So I'm saying that because somebody reached out to me, one of the listeners reached out to me and was, you know, talked about the things that they're doing, and I could tell that they were feeling a sense of hopelessness and despair. And I'm going to assume that there are going to be other people listening who feel hopelessness and despair. So I say your discrete task between now and November is focus on voter suppression, the voting rights, getting people registered, getting out the vote, because that is where there could be change in this country.
I considered renaming this program Hopelessness and Despair. I mean, it's hard to think, and you're so right. You made this point yesterday, and you make it today about voting rights. And you also said, I mean, it's just one thing after another. So you put all of this together. This is a public that is largely, the polls show this, that is more and more fatigued. It doesn't know what to do and is doesn't want to give up, but certainly is far away from any victory that allows them a glimmer that things like this won't just continue to happen week after week after week after week until 2028.
Yeah. I'm curious, Joe, you said that this story, I mean, it's getting a lot of attention, but you think it maybe should get even more attention. So, you know, you're following the news every day. What struck you about it that makes it even more, you know, in a series of things that are out of the ordinary, why is this even more out of the ordinary?
Because if you set up a slush fund to go after your enemies, that is an authoritarian act. And it is to me, we have seen many authoritarian acts. And when you put them together and then you start funding them with billions and billions of dollars, to me, you are just setting up the foundation and the latticework for whatever you have planned, which I believe does not include democracy in that.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I mean, this story is still so new. I am really curious what other Republicans are going to say about it, because I mean, this is not a good look for exactly the reason you're saying, and I can't imagine that there's going to be a lot of Republicans who come out and defend it. But maybe I'm wrong about that.
I mean, I think that the contradiction, you know, people say, you know, Trump suing himself. He's not suing himself. He's setting up the table so that he wins a lawsuit that the American public pays for. And $1.8 billion in the scale of the federal budget is not a ton of money. That's the entire NSF budget times two.
No, that's true.
So childhood cancer research that got canceled was far less than that. So when people say $1.8 billion, it sounds like a lot to the naked ear, but in the scheme of the federal budget, it's not.
But it
sets important things.
That's mm-hmm. right, but it sets up the infrastructure.
Yeah.
It sets up the infrastructure so that the next $5.8 billion can go into that exact fund.
Yeah. Well, I mean, technically, that judicial fund is bottomless. There's no cap on it.
Well, there you go.
Which is crazy to me that like, this is something I'd never sort of heard of before. The Justice Department's fund. I forget what the proper name for the fund is.
Yeah, but Congress set it up.
Technically has no cap on it, which is...
And again,
you know, unbelievable.
And this whole idea, this whole naive quirk that we continue to come back to, that the Congress controls the purse. Well, mm-hmm. No, they don't anymore. They obviously don't. And so, yeah, I don't. Yeah, so I'm hopeless.
And again, this is part of my point with micromedia, man. For all like the manosphere talking about masculinity. If I'm running the DNC, I'm on the phone with my people saying you're doing 2 media hits a week. I don't care. Like, everybody and their mother has a podcast. Get on local TV. And one of the drums I would beat is the idea of masculinity. Like, you, whoever your Republican adversary is, just, you know, gave up their... to the president.
So we
right?
So get clavicular on this?
No. But actually, like, get on micromedia and talk about the idea that, like, this is what the Constitution mandates, that the money come from Congress, and that Congress is giving this up cheap all the time.
Yes.
And it's not...
But Justin, that's not
that's somebody else. That's taxpayer money. That's your money. Every dollar you make, that's, you know, 30 cents of that is being given away.
Fatima, we only have we have less than a minute, but make your final point.
Yeah, I just think that you have to expect that they're going to do more of this, and the Democrats, the corporate Democrats, aren't going to do anything. So if you know that going in, then you devise a plan and a strategy expecting no help from them. And so the help that needs to come is from people, because people still have power. They need to come up with their own strategy and implementation plan for how to counter what the government is doing and how to hold people accountable. I think that begins with some voting rights as a focus, and don't expect the Dems to do anything. And I think if you know that, who your opponents are, then you can come up with an action plan. But just expect more triflingness, because that is the train that the country is currently on.
We're going to hold it there for this morning. My thanks to all of our wonderful panelists. Justin Patch, always good to have you here. Thank you very much. Fatima Gilliam, thank you very much. I appreciate your words, and I appreciate you being here as always. Laurel Elder, we're going to hold you after class. We're going to talk about the new book, Not Going Back. We'll take a break and go over to Lockbox Central, and we'll be back with Laurel Elder after this.